dear friends, we're continuing with the series of the lives of the patriarchs. And we're going to commence in the 33rd chapter at the 18th verse. Of course, we're going to consider the 34th, but we need the 18th as a background for our remarks. It says, "And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. When he came from Paddan Aram, and pitched his tent before the city, and he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money, and he erected there an altar and called it Elohim Israel." Now, I'd like you to note, dear friends, that in this journey, he was coming towards Bethel. Bethel was the place, you remember, where the ladder had come down from heaven and stood on the earth beside him, and where Jacob had been given the assurance that the covenant belonged to him, that the promise was his, that God would be with him, would sustain him, and bring him back. There were many, many experiences which Jacob had had since he left Bethel. Over 40 years had elapsed since that time. But you notice, all the way on his return journey, while on the one hand he had a measure of faith, on the other hand, it was offset oftentimes by fear. Fear, of course, is the lack of faith. It is for this reason that we find so much comfort in the study of these pictures, that we see that those who received a good report through faith, or because of their faith, did not always measure up to the highest standards, and that the grace of God made possible their continuance before him as though they were faithful. It wasn't their own righteousness, but it was the righteousness of God imputed to them because of the measure of faith they were able to exercise, despite the fact that they were not begotten of the Holy Spirit, despite the fact that they did not have what you and I have as guideposts to the way of godly living. You notice I didn't say Christian living. I said, godly living. Now, on the way coming back, he made the same mistake that Lot made before him. Instead of seeking to establish himself on high ground, he rested in the lowlands. Shechem was in the plain. It was in the lowlands. Bethel was on a mountain. It was an elevated ground. The difference is the same as between the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities of the plain, and Mamre, where Abraham, full of faith, established himself. But Jacob did not go to Bethel, but he stopped at Shechem. Not that God had indicated he should stop there, but he thought he'd rest. And if you think it was just a rest for a moment, or a day or two, you're mistaken, because he purchased the land. So it would appear that he had intended to stay. This was Canaan, true enough. But all of Canaan isn't the place that God would have you in. He wants you in the high places, in the lofty places, where you can be bathed in the sunshine of his peace. And if you do not avail yourself of the privilege of ascending the hills of God, from whence comes your strength, and you live in the valleys of the plain, if God is still dealing with you, you can rest. rest assured that he will chasten you by way of experiences which will make you despise yourself, hate yourself, and wish to leave where you are to go where God is. And so we find that Jacob here had gone to Shechem. If he had not stopped at Shechem, but gone on to Bethel, the lesson of the afternoon would probably never have been recorded. The lesson is recorded to show the manner and the means which God often employs when we do not seek to stand on the high and holy ground, but rather stand on the level of the flesh. We say stand on the level of the flesh not to imply by that we have lost our faith and our confidence and trust in God and all the precious promises. No, but that despite these, we leave to our own understanding. How often did Jacob just lean to his own understanding, use his own ingenuity, his own experiences, as it were, as an aid to extricate himself out of difficult places? It wasn't uncommon for him to use methods by which others might be deceived. And these very same traits manifest themselves in the children of Jacob in after years. And so it says here, and he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it Elohi Israel, which means God is the God of Israel. Now, while that is very noble, that's a beautiful sentiment, still, you'll find that it is different when he erects again and rededicates the altar at Bethel, which is later than this. It's no longer God, the God of Israel, but God, the house. God of the house of God, recognizing that he himself was to that extent a member of the house over which the God of Israel was on. I trust you see the antitypical significance of this. It's nice to erect an altar to the God of the universe. It's nice to recognize him as the God of all Christians. But to recognize God as your habitation, as the place where you dwell, that's something higher. That's something nobler. That's something sweeter. For that comes only to the extent that we leave the cities of the plain to find our place on the high and exalted Mount of God. You'll notice that generally God speaks from the mountaintops. Jesus, when he wished to be alone, he would withdraw himself and go to the mountains. When Jesus taught the multitudes, he went into the mountains. There's always some place where the exaltation would have a tendency to affect the minds of those that might be drawn unto him. And so God draws us up to the high places for the same reason, that our minds might not be centered upon the things of the earth, but that they might concentrate upon the nobler things which he has to present to our view. You will remember that when Moses was to receive the instructions as to the building of the tabernacle, it was even necessary for him to fast 40 days and 40 nights. Sometimes people fast during the day and they start eating in the night. But it wasn't so. He fasted 40 days, 40 nights. And you know, that enabled him to think clearly. To think clearly on the things that God had to show him. And when God says, see that thou make it according to the pattern shown thee in the mount, this helped him when he came into the valley, into the plain below, without a tabernacle shadow booklet, without out of the book of Exodus to give, as it were, a perfect detailed outline for the building of the tabernacle. So God, when he wants to bless you and give you something that you are to retain in your heart and in your mind, he will ask you to fast. Fast from what? Not necessarily natural foods, although these sometimes help, but to fast from things that pertain to the earth, the worldly things, not the things that are wrong necessarily, but the things that make inroads on your time, the things that might rightly be yours, rightly the peoples of the world. But if you would have the higher and the nobler experience with God, he may ask that you abstain from these, even fellowship soft times, for the specific purpose that he can impress upon your mind the lessons that he will teach you. And so we find that it tells us here that Jacob erected an altar to the God of Israel. Now that's just common, ordinary language. In other words, there isn't anything too noble about it. Noble enough, yes. But you'll see the difference between the man who stands in the lowlands of the plain and the man who stands on the mount with God. Now, in order that he might get the lesson that was needful for him, God hadn't instructed him to stop at Shechem. And Shechem, as you know, was in the land of Canaan, but the dwellers in the land of Canaan were not the people of God. And so too, in a mystical sense, we now possess the land of Canaan. Let me say, your own heart, which God has given to you, and the heart which belongs to God. In it you might find peace and rest and comfort. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those that dwell within, that is what Israel of old needed to do, to drive out. God says, I've given you the land. Oh yes, he's given it to you. But there's something that you must do about it. And if you're beguiled or taken in by the Canaanites who dwell in the land, you will find that you're going to lose time and you're going to lose the lesson. Sometime you may have said, well, I certainly am so sorry that I didn't do this long ago, that I didn't consecrate when I was much younger. Yes, you feel that way about it, but there's nothing now that you can do about that except redouble your energy and get all that you can. Perhaps the fact that you made this decision so late will be a greater incentive to you now to be more faithful, that your time is less. And it says, and Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which he bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Dinah is the only daughter of Jacob that we know of. He had 13 children, so far as the accounts record. And Dinah was an only daughter. She had 6 brethren by Leah, the first wife of Jacob. And I'd like you to note that it says here that she went out to see the daughters of the land. This implies, dear friends, that she knew the daughters of the land. Their sojourn here probably lasted about 7 years before they left it. And she may have been somewhere between 12 and 16 years of age at this time. But in the East, girls reach puberty much sooner than they do in other parts of the world, and consequently are considered of marriageable age at a much younger time than they would be anywhere else. But at any rate, we note here that neither Jacob nor Leah nor any of her brethren interposed any objections to Dinah's going to visit the daughters of the land of Shechem. You see, there is where a part of the responsibility lies. That is a responsibility that we all have, more or less, toward one another. Of course, you can mind your own business. That's just what the world says. You just mind your own business. And of course, you have to. But when it concerns the children of the covenant, then everyone who has a share in that covenant is everybody else's keeper. And I think that this is part of the reason why the brethren of Dinah acted as they did. We'll see. But she went to visit the daughters of the land. It doesn't tell us what the occasion was. It may have been a fair. Josephus has a festival. I don't know how he knows. It doesn't say. All we know is that she went there, there must have been a social gathering. And the people of the land certainly were not people of the covenant. And any time that you fraternize, fellowship, assemble, meet with, mix with people of the land, you're leaving yourself open to something that may prove very, very serious. Because it's very subtle. They're good people. Of course they're good. They're better than some of the other people that you know. Yes, that's true. And how true. But you see, dear friends, they're not the children of the covenant. And why should you spend time in social activities, in social engagements, in meeting them just to be social? You can't do it. Because if you do, immediately you lose something. It may only be a measure of the respect that they had for you once. Do you understand what I mean? Well, I didn't expect to see you here. Oh, you didn't? No, of course, I didn't expect to see you here. Why? Well, somehow or other, I never did feel that this was the kind of a thing that you would care to attend. Yeah. So the Lord has given you the reproof by way of one in the world. You see, you lose something. And that which you lose, they'll always remember it. Any good thing that you do? Yes. As Shakespeare says, the good that we do is interred with our bones. The bad, that lives after. So she went down there to visit the daughters of the land. Probably not the first time, not the second time. Perhaps there were many times she had visited there. And it says, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the county. Now, I do not consider that Shechem was the prince, but that Hamor, his father, was the prince. And that Shechem was the son of the prince. And that it was Shechem, the son of the prince, after whom the country was named Shechem. But if you have a different thought, you're welcome to it. It's just the difference in as to where you place the comma or the quotation, punctuation marks. So it says, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and humbled her. Your record says defiled. The Hebrew says humbled. It has the same significance. Now, on the surface of it, it might appear as though this was all one-sided, as though Dinah may have had nothing at all to do with it. But I have doubts about that. I think she was probably a little enamored of the prince, the son, the chieftain's son, so to speak. young girl to be taken in. Well, I guess he's a nice fellow. He's a good catch. Well, say it today, don't they? And I wouldn't be surprised if she may have felt that way, too. And so he took her to his house. And, as we would say, defiled her. But notice, dear friends, that what Shechem did was not pure lust, nor was it merely uncontrolled passion. For had it been either one of these, the result would have been, as we find it recorded,
in 2 Samuel, the 13th chapter, verses 1 to 17, concerning Amnon and his half-sister.
After having succeeded in getting his half-sister to lie with him, then he despised her and hated her and cast her out. Those of you who have read the story will remember. And that is generally the way of men. They promise the world, they promise everything, and after they've got what they want, they throw away what they've got. They don't want it, you see. But in this case, it tells us definitely that Shechem's heart was toward Dinah. He loved her. And you say, well, if anybody loves, how could they do such a thing? Well, I'll ask you the question. How could they? Haven't you done some things that people whom you profess to love might turn around and ask you, is this an evidence of your love for me? And if you don't have to say that, then I'll say, we'll let you answer the question. But it's quite evident from the account here that it was not mere lust, but that he loved the girl and probably figured this was the best way of getting consent of the father. Notice it says, and Shechem and his soul clave unto Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel and spake kindly unto the damsel. And Shechem spake unto his father, Hamor, saying, get me this damsel to wife. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. Now you notice, dear friends, that must have been an awful trial for Jacob, his daughter, his only daughter, to be defiled by a Shechemite who was not a person who was included in the covenant. An uncircumcised individual to have defiled his daughter. And yet Jacob had to hold his peace until the brethren came in after the close of the day, coming in from the field. And they then learned of what had happened. Now, you see, Jacob was the father of a mixed family. He had 4 groups of children. But, you see, Jacob didn't take it upon himself to avenge himself, but the brothers of Dinah undertook to avenge her. Now I want you to note, dear friends, we're going slowly because there is a lesson here that is very important that we should get. And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with the cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. And Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly, it says in Israel, in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. Now there's evidently something wrong with this translation. Israel did not as yet exist. There was no Israel except Jacob. So there was no folly wrought in Israel. The folly was wrought against Israel, that is, against Jacob, because of the fact that Shechem had lain with Jacob's daughter. I want you to notice the words there. Folly against Israel, because he had lain with Jacob's daughter. I don't know whether that means anything, whether it has any connotation in your mind, any significance at all, but to me it has this. Israel means a prince with God. Jacob means a planter. And in every one of us who are children of the covenant, there are two natures represented. In one, we bear a new name, like Jacob did, a prince with God. In the other, our old nature, not the sinful nature, but our old nature, in which there is much of sin, corresponds to that which the plant. There was a time when you were of the world, but probably you had no regard for things that were spiritual. But there came a time when, as a natural man, you began to become interested in these things. You weren't born again. You weren't begotten again. But there was a new mind to the old creature. That new mind supplanted the old one which existed before. But it was still of the flesh. It wasn't of the spirit. And only after Jacob had wrestled with God was his name changed. And only after you and I have wrestled for the promises and wrestled for a place with God was our name changed at the time when we were begotten of God's Holy Spirit and we got a new name. We were new creatures in Christ Jesus. But the old nature is still there, isn't it? I don't mean the sinful nature, but the old nature which has been justified by faith, and concerning which the Apostle Paul says, "In my flesh there dwelleth no good thing." It wasn't an idea with Paul that he was sinful, deliberately wicked, because he says, if the law hadn't said so and so, I wouldn't be aware of sin. But when the law said, thou shalt not covet, immediately he felt himself as being under sin, as being a sinner. So we see that even though Paul, or Saul of Tarsus, was not begotten of the Holy Spirit at the time when he journeyed toward Damascus, nevertheless, his mind was one who sought to do the will of God. In fact, he believed that he was doing the will of God all the time. So you see, when Paul speaks of the old man, he doesn't speak of the man with a nature that is sinful in that sense of the word, but he speaks of a man whose every desire was to do the will of God, but how to do it that he couldn't find. Nor even after he was begotten of the Holy Spirit, after he had become a new creature, he still knew what was the good thing to do, but how to do it, that he could not find because of the inhibitions of the flesh. And so we say, dear friends, there is that which corresponds to our higher nature, which God chooses to look at only. But there is a lesser nature. Surely we shouldn't be made up of two natures, but I speak of it only in the sense that there is the mind of the spirit and the mind of the flesh, as Paul says, which are continually at warfare one with the other. And so long as you live in the flesh, there will be the actions of the flesh. And these will always be contrary to the spirit. And it is the new mind, the new creature, that has to bring into subjection the old nature. You may have heard me say this before, that when a woman is with child, she sometimes says, oh, I mustn't do this and I mustn't do that. As if she were looking out for the unborn child. But actually, it is not she that is looking out, but it is the unborn child within her that causes her to look out. And so it isn't our old nature that is taking care of the new creature, but it's the new creature, yet unborn, merely begotten, that takes care of the flesh, endeavoring to bring it into subjection of the new mind. And so, the folly was against the new nature, as it were, but the sin was committed against the old. In other words, sometimes, dear friends, you may feel that somebody has injured you or hurt you. What is it that has been injured? What is it that has been hurt? Surely the new nature cannot be hurt. But it's the old one that can. And so in these words, it seems to me there is a mystical significance. He was grieved. And they were very wrong. Because Shechem had wrought folly against Israel, lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. Now, dear friends, if you don't want that old nature of yours to be hurt, don't put it any place where it can be hurt. You see, that's the thought. If Jacob hadn't stayed at Shechem, Dinah would never have desired to see the daughters of Shechem. And if she'd never been down to see the daughters of Shechem, the prince Shechem would never have seen her and never desired her and never defiled her. But you see, it was because of the fact that Jacob stopped short of his goal, that he had to learn the lessons. And the lessons always come by way of those that are near and dear to us. Satan knows better than to try you by way of somebody that doesn't pull the strings of your heart. It's somebody that you love. It's somebody that you revere. Those are the ones that he works upon so as to influence you. And God could prevent it. But when you are in the lowlands instead of the highlands, then God says, yes, I'll permit this trial to come. My child needs this chastening. And so the chastening comes. And so we find that in this case, that Hamor communed with them, saying, the soul of my son, Shechem, longeth for your daughter. I pray you, give her him to wife. And make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. And ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possession therein. Now you see, here was the suggestion of Hamor. You know, there's nothing that the world would like better than have you live right in the midst of it. It would like to reciprocate in many ways. You give me this and I'll give you that. And of course, after you get through with this and with that, you're just as much of the world as they are. Because what they have to give you would naturally be of the world. And what you would have to give them only has value because it enhances something of the world that they already possess. So you see, you are the loser. They gain on all points. And now, here was the suggestion that you just let my son have Dinah to wife. And then you just mix in with us, marry our daughters. Our daughters will marry your sons. The land is yours. We'll trade together and we will live along peacefully. In Shechem, not at Bethel. Do you understand? You see, dear friend, it looks all right to a person that stands in the plain, but it's all wrong from the person who views the plain from the mountain. I've learned more about this a about the city of New York in this last week or two. I never knew that this city was as wicked as it really is. I knew it was wicked, but not as wicked as I know it to be now. I sometimes wonder whether the city isn't worse than Sodom and Gomorrah ever was. I could tell you stories that would just turn you white that I have learned about the city. And you know, it just makes you feel foolhardy. And so much of it, too, is done with the protection of the powers that be. And Shechem said unto his father and to her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes, and what ye shall say unto me, I will give. Now, in other words, whatever you ask, I love your sister Dinah so much. I really want her to be mine. I've never seen a more beautiful girl, maiden, than Dinah. And anything that you ask, I'll be glad to give it. Now, that's saying a great deal. That might have meant houses, lands, cattle, or any number of things. But I want you to notice the duplicity of the sons of Jacob. And I say, in a measure, they came by it very naturally. He says, ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I will give according as you shall say unto me, but give me the damsel to wife. I wonder, dear friends, how much you're willing to pay for what you want. Do you want a place in the bride of Christ? Do you want to be a sharer with Jesus in the glory of the kingdom? How much would you give? What's the dowry? Sometimes I feel that this Shechemite puts us to shame. There wasn't anything that he considered too much. There were no ifs, no ands, no buts. It was everything. But you know, when a young man and a woman get married, say, for better or for worse. Yes, of course. But when it gets to be worse, then it's no better. You understand what I mean? At any rate, we find Shechem here. He's willing to give everything. And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully, and said, because he defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. Oh, and the cloak of religion. Much is done. We can't do this. But the very thing that they refused to do when he offered to give it are the very things that they took later on when it wasn't given to them, when they robbed and pillaged and stole it. You understand, dear friends? That shows the human heart. We just say no because we want to be right. We may be wrong, but we say no. And later on, we say yes. Oh, but you said no before. Oh, no, you misunderstood. That's good. You see, they were the children of the covenant. That's the thing that makes the lesson so poignant for us. Children of the covenant. Heirs of the promise. And look at them. They answered deceitfully. We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach to us. But in this will we consent unto you. Now I want you to note, dear friends, that the covenant, the mark of the covenant, was circumcision, a mark in the flesh. Now that was the mark, all right, but that wasn't circumcision. The faith in the heart, the faith of Abraham. Circumcision was only the outward mark of that relationship with God by which they would become heirs of the promise. If they had been sincere, they would have said, well, now, Shechem, since it's contrary to the covenant that we have with our God, that anyone but a circumcised individual should be the husband of one of our daughters, we insist that you become circumcised. But no, you see, their deceitfulness was already manifest. Not only would Shechem need to be circumcised, but all the males among them. And notice, but in this will we consent unto you. In other words, we'll give you Dinah if you will be as we be. Now, that's just exactly what they promised they would be. Just exactly as they were. They would wear the mark of circumcision, of covenant relationship, which certainly in those sons of Jacob was not as deep as it was in Abraham. Of course not. So, it says, if you will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then will we give our daughters unto you, and we will take your daughters unto us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. Covenant. Children of the covenant. I often wondered why the Apostle Paul in one place says, lie not one to another. I never thought that would be needful. What we see here, we find it very evident here in the sons of the patriarch Jacob. He had deceived his father. Deception follows all the way along. And it's not at all surprising what you sow, that you reap. You can't sow peaches and get onions, nor can you sow garlic and expect to reap lilies of the valley. You understand? You sow, and as you sow, you will reap. That is an inexorable law. Don't think that any test in his life that he can do anything that he pleases and not bear a retributive atonement for it. But if, in other words, we will become one people, but if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then will we take our daughter and we will be gone. Now you see, Shechem could have said, all right, take Dinah. If he hadn't loved her, he would have said, that's the wisdom of Solomon, isn't it? Remember when those two women claimed the same little baby? And so Solomon says, well, I'll cut it in half and give each half. One says, yes, I wanted my half. And the other one says, oh, no, let her have both halves. So he gave the child to the one who didn't want the child. You see, here's the wisdom of Solomon. Now, we say, we find it marked here, but if you will not hearken unto us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will be gone. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. Now, naturally they would. Why wouldn't these words please them? They were happy to know that Dinah would be the wife of Shechem. And being the wife of Shechem, they'd all be one. Now, you see, that is just exactly the kind of a compromise the world wants. They're willing to bear the outward marks of Christianity. They're outwardly willing to bear the marks of consecration. But they're not changed of heart. They'll be just as you want them to be. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, you say you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't play cards. You don't do a lot of those things you see that other people do. Well, that's only an outward sign. You could be without all of these things and still not be right in your heart. But there are those in the world, in the nominal church, who do not drink, who do not smoke, who do not play cards, who do not dance, who do not do these things. They bear, as it were, the outward marks of a covenant relationship with God. And they would be happy to have you with them. They'll give you everything. They'll make you a Sunday school teacher. They'll make you a Sunday school superintendent. They'll make you this and that in the church and give you lots of honor and ample opportunity to trade, as it were, in the markets of churchianity. Yes. They're willing to bear the outward marks of circumcision. But I want to tell you something, dear friends. As time goes by, I didn't get quite as far with this lesson as I thought we would get. Insofar as the covenant was concerned, the mark was circumcision. Now, God purposely, when he instituted this as a rite, now, circumcision wasn't only practiced among the Jews. It was practiced among the Egyptians and among the Phoenicians, other Canaanites. They practiced it too. It wasn't something, but with the nation of Israel, it wasn't a case of maybe, yes, maybe, no. It had to be, and it now represented something definite. It represented the covenant relationship with God. And while Abraham was an old man the time that he was circumcised, nevertheless, the law of it became the eighth day of a young male child's life. Now, there are reflexes at that time, but the sensations of pain are not there. Oh, yes, there are some reflexes and so forth. They'll cry even without being hurt, even when they're born, won't they? They don't know what they're crying about, but they just cry. Well, it's natural for them to cry. They breathe in and get air into their lungs and oxygenizes the blood, and you know, and that makes them living creatures after a while. That is robust and healthy. It helps. But you see, those are reflexes, and they can endure circumcision at that time without the pain. But when it's an adult, then it becomes a serious matter. And by the third day, inflammation and fever set in. And sometimes they have to remain quiet for 30 to 35 days. Now this was what the sons of Jacob,
whose sister was Dinah, knew.
And they would weaken these people, put them in the position where they couldn't resist, and then when they got them into that position, bludgeon them, destroy them, kill them. Now that wasn't all that they did. They not only killed all the people and the innocent men among the Shechemites, but they took the women, they took the children, they took whatever they could of the cattle as spoils of war. Children of the covenant? Dear friends, if they couldn't enter into it, can we enter into it? Do we have any more of the godly spirit in our hearts, in our minds? Or do we seek to take advantage, weaken someone else to the point where they can't and take advantage of their weakness? The Bible says, ye that are strong, bear not only bear the infirmities, but bear with the infirmities of the weak. That's the spirit of the true child. child of the covenant. Now you see, there was an earthly face of the covenant. There is a heavenly face of the covenant. But in one we have the shadow, in the other we have the substance. And so whatever you see reflected in these sons of Jacob, if you look carefully enough, you may find it in your own heart. They sought to avenge the honor of their sister. And God says, vengeance is mine. And then when you remember, dear friends, the great sorrow that came upon Jacob, what he learned, what these sons had done, to what extent he was responsible, we say, if he had never gone to Shechem, it would never have happened. If he'd gone on to Bethel, it never would have happened. No. Had he been on the high ground. But it's because you and I allow ourselves sometimes to gravitate to the low ground, and instead of merely staying there a little while, we settle down as he did. And it is for this reason that God permits adverse experiences to come to us. And in these adverse experiences, what happens to us? Well, people say, is that your religion? Then your religion and you begin. Now, you say, Brother Fry, I wish you wouldn't use that word, but the Bible uses it. Jacob says, you cause me to stink among the people. You know, something vile. And it got so that Jacob realized it was no place for him to stay. And there was no vision while he was at Shechem until after he had been chastened. And then God says,